Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's gonna hate you. She's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nature Bat's Last Radio Show. I'm Pauline Schneider in New York, and this is the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. This is a pre-recorded show, so I won't be able to take any calls, but please feel free to comment on the Nature Bat's Last on PRN.FM Facebook group page. Our theme song is provided as a gift by Afrozen, and you can find more of his work on SoundCloud. Our SOS background sound is provided by 17-year-old Rianne Farragan. And our PRN engineer is Jason Taubenfeld. I'm filling in today for Guy and Mike. Tonight, I'll be speaking with Joey and Holly Baird, the founders of the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener. And they'll be talking about growing food while having a day job and a variety of other amazing things. Now, for an update on Guy's European tour and our fundraiser for him, with unprecedented support from our friends around the world, our Send a Friend fundraiser has met its goal, and many of you are still feeling generous and wanting to donate, and we're really, really grateful for that. And Guy very much appreciates any extra funds that will all go towards his medical bills and all those unexpected costs during his tour, like a hotel or dinners, train tickets, blood tests, snacks, Wi-Fi on the train, cabs, you know, the whole thing. Apparently, his insurance company doesn't cover the blood tests overseas. So that's nice. So, you know, because Guy uses a gift economy, not all of his expenses get covered, and he often has to pay out of pocket. And I realize this might seem fine to most people, but considering that he actually doesn't even get paid or compensated financially or otherwise for his lecture tours, it's actually a terrible business plan and leads very quickly to red ink ledgers. So we're trying to solve this problem, and Team Guy is working on it very hard. You know, we talk a lot about how to help the situation. Right now, Guy is currently in Zurich, Switzerland, with host and tour organizer Edwin Moser. And if you've been following him on Facebook, you'll see all of his just absolutely wonderful video posts and photos of his trip. And you may have noticed he's sporting a new Austrian hat and shirt, thanks to our very good friend Robert Leisure, who hosted him in Salzburg. Robert also got Ariadne a hat, and she looks absolutely adorable in it. So I'm really, really bummed out that I didn't go on this trip to get my Austrian hat as well. I could look like I was in the Sound of Music as well. But anyway, thumbs the brakes. So Guy's next destination will be in Geneva. And then Friday, he's on to London and Bristol, where his hosts and organizers are Lee Nelson and Chris Summerall, and they're very excited to meet him. And then Sunday, he goes to Reykjavik, Iceland, for 3 days, and hopefully he'll be warm and have enough warm clothes for that. And after that, he goes back to London for one more day and then heads home to the Mud Hut for a much-deserved rest. This man has been going and going and going. He's like the Energizer Bunny. So if you're in Geneva or Reykjavik or Bristol or London and you have not met the doctor yet and you still want to, go to www.guymcpherson.net to register for any of the upcoming events and find out their locations and times. this could be your last chance to meet the doctor in Europe. And if you visited Guy's Nature Bat's Last page lately, you may have come across several critical comments about Guy's travels. Some are criticizing him for flying. And we've heard this one before, but really? We can't get past that? Really? You know those flights were going to fly anyway without that one person on it, right? You do know that, right, people? The science shows the planes are actually helping. Really? We're still going to go on about flying? You do realize it's a passive form of geoengineering. And if you don't know why, you might try either reading the long essay on the Nature Bat's Last blog or watching the Global Dimming documentary. Or you can Google Tim Garrett's interview on the University of Utah's news website, unewscenter.utah.edu, in an article titled, Is Global Warming Unstoppable? So in this article, Garrett points out, quote, stabilization of carbon dioxide emissions at current rates will require approximately 300 gigawatts of new non-carbon dioxide emitting power production capacity annually. Approximately one new nuclear power plant, or its equivalent, per day. Physically, there are no other options without killing the economy. End quote. We know the economy is everything. So, really, do you need me to repeat that? That was a pretty long and drawn-out sentence. But really, you would need a new nuclear power plant per day. So if you're really so worried about one man riding a plane across the ocean enough to write a nasty comment about it, I think you might need to rethink your priorities. So basically, and Guy constantly quotes Garrett in his presentation. And the quote is that civilization is a heat engine. This is what civilization is. It doesn't matter whether you ride a bike or put solar panels on your house or stop flying altogether. As long as civilization is here, it's a heat engine. So let's just get over the fact that not flying will make any darn difference. It's not. In fact, not flying will bring the system down faster, as we saw on 9/11, when 3 days of grounded flights caused a temperature spike of 1°C globally. Yes, that was just 3 days of artificial collapse caused a 1°C temperature rise. Now, imagine a few weeks of that, or a few months, and it's coming. It's absolutely coming. As for the disparaging comments, Guy noticed and commented thusly, quote, apparently I failed to mention I'm traveling and therefore forgot to ask you to behave. Feel free to continue your disparagement of informed people when I'm back home in a couple weeks, end quote. Well, that's Guy's really nice way of saying shut the F up, which he rarely says. He saves it for special moments. Speaking of the long essay at his website, I really wanted to mention that, you know, May 22nd marks 2 years from my first meeting and hearing Guy speak. And at that time, there were only 12 positive self-reinforcing feedback loops. And today, there are a whopping 49. And the other day, I was talking to Wendy Bandersky-Miller, and she thought that, you know, maybe there should be 50, and the 50th one could be the stupid human behavior feedback loop. You know, the behavior like banning inconvenient words like global warming and climate change, or planning on installing a highly pressurized natural gas line right next to a nuclear power plant in proximity of, 20 million people, or maybe building a bitumen oil pipeline over the nation's largest water aquifer, or pretending that we're actually given a choice of candidates in our next presidential election. So maybe the stupid human behavior feedback loop is the gift that keeps on giving, like lemmings off a cliff. I just just one of those incredible things that I think it should definitely be the 50th one. You hearing this guy? One of the stupid human behavior feedbacks is the unwillingness to relinquish our myths and our mythical heroes, which leads to interactions like the one I had this past Friday at a screening of Going Dark at a local educational film center, the Jacob Burns Film Center. It was a wonderful, wonderful resource in our community. A gentleman who had seen the film was concerned with Guy's criticism of Bill McKibben and James Hansen, and he was upset they were being called liars. He's calling them liars. And I pointed out to him, well, they did lie. They lied to us. They lied to us that we could keep CO2 levels at 350, and they lied to us that we could reduce them in our lifetime. And we know from the science that that is not possible, that we're locked in for at least 1,000 years at whatever level we're at. And guess what? We're at 404 parts per million now. So, you know, this is the amazing disconnect that I see in people. They're upset that their heroes are being called on the carpet for their crimes, but they're not actually upset about the crimes themselves. It's like that poor girl who was gang raped by those high school football players, and the community was so upset about the future of these boys. Their future was ruined. But they weren't that upset about the victim who'd been violated. It just was so, it's like, you know, your priorities are really confused. And I blame that kind of logical fallacy on religious indoctrination that prevents critical thinking. But that's a different discussion for a different day and maybe another different radio show. So I'm Pauline Schneider. I'm sitting in for Guy McPherson and Michael Sliva. And this is Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network .fm, PRN.fm. Joining me now are Joey and Holly Baird. And I'm especially happy to welcome them, being a fellow lifelong organic gardener. Holly is not only an avid gardener, she's also an award-winning home canner with a handful of ribbons from the Wisconsin State Fair. And she's an environmental science student. She graduates this coming summer. Joey is a lifelong gardener with a family background in agriculture. And they both have day jobs, and they do this incredible work in the evening in their after hours. And I'm just really, really, really so happy to have you here on the show today. Welcome, Joey and Holly. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us. It's actually just me today, Holly, but thank you for having me on.
Well, Holly, thank you so much for being on. I'm so happy to speak with you. You know, I was looking at your website and your blog page and your YouTube channel. It's amazing. It's just full of incredible and practical information for growing food and canning and really just a lot of really good information out there. You have a YouTube channel with over 4,000 subscribers and a wonderful podcast. It's called the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener podcast.podomatic.com. And you have 137 instructional videos on YouTube. So for all the beginners out there, you guys are an amazing resource for them. How did you start this? What inspired you?
Well, we had actually started with just a Facebook page. We noticed that there wasn't any Facebook pages for... there was a vegetable gardening page, but there really wasn't anything for, like, the Midwest or Wisconsin. And while our information is applicable worldwide, we had wanted to do kind of seasonal stuff for Wisconsin. So we started with a Facebook page. And then about a year after that, I had one video camera from where I was working at the time. And we had noticed we would get a lot of questions from people that would say, you know, how do I do this? How do I do that? And we could give them, you know, resources, take pictures, whatever. But once we had the video camera, then at that point, I told Joey, I said, we should try to make some videos and see what happens. And Joey is very organized. And his brain is a very organized brain. and thought, well, maybe we should make videos. We should make, you know, make them formatted so that there's, you know, good editing and there's a flow and it's not just a video. So that's where we had come up with, like, kind of like a television style show with segments and the intro and everything. And so it kind of grew from there. Then after we had a few videos out, then we created the website. And then about a year and a half ago, we decided to put out the quarterly digital magazine. And then this past fall is when we decided that we were going to start the podcast.
That's fantastic. Yeah, the podcasts are a great idea. And it's great because you can bring them with you and listen to them, you know, when you're driving down the road or people are take the train or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, one of the comments I noticed Joey was making in one of the videos is, as long as we have the internet, you have access to this information.
Right.
And I thought that was great because a lot of people haven't made that connection yet.
No.
But you guys are thinking that way, so I really appreciate that. And, you know, being a radio show called Nature Bats Last, you know, nature will, you know, she'll get rid of the internet eventually. But what do you find are, you know, all the people that come to you and all the different questions that they have, do you have, you know, questions that they ask that, you know, obviously the most common ones and, you know, when do I start planting my tomatoes and that sort of thing. But are there others that you really find are really interesting and moving toward, you know, get
generally
for people?
A lot of times the favorite question that stumps us, it's something that somebody did to their soil that they shouldn't have done or done to their plant that they maybe try, you know, like they've been doing something for 5 years the same way, and this year they decided to try something new. And that's not always a bad thing, but if you're having success with something continually year after year and then you try something new and it doesn't work, it's not really always a surprise. That's kind of like reinventing the wheel. It's not always good. If you're frustrated though because you're not having success, and you try something new, that makes a lot of sense. But if you are having success and then you try something new and it doesn't work, then it's like, well, why did you do that? But we do have a lot of resources where we can help people. We had a woman recently who basically she added too much peat moss to her seed starts, the mix that she puts her seed starts in, and now she has too much acid. And we're one of our resources is going to see if there's something they could do to bring it back to the base so that acid goes down. So, yeah. So I guess the thing is that, yeah, we get the typical questions about, you know, my tomatoes doing this or my cucumbers are doing this or whatever, but then we get people that, I guess, get a little overzealous and maybe they should have just left things how they were.
Over-fertilizing is a pretty interesting problem.
Yes.
Do you have people asking you, I mean, really just nuts and bolts, how do I, you know, I want to grow food, but I've never done this before? And
oh, yeah. I have a jacket that has our name on it, the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener, and I was at some store where I buy tea from, and the cashier was like, you know, I want to start a vegetable garden. Can you help me? And then I started talking with her about our website and videos and things, and I gave her some ideas to get started, and she was just so grateful. She, you know, she had never done anything like that before, and, you know, within 10 minutes, I had given her some good instruction, and then and I haven't heard from her since, but I would have said she's coming to the website. We also started a series last year that we have a complete series of it. It was called First Gardener, New Gardener. And that's on our website, and we broke it down from the basics, from starting seeds to planning out a garden to where to put stuff to, you know, if you're looking at your backyard, what to be aware of, or wherever you're going to plant, you know, before you plant, and all sorts of great information. So that was from start to harvest. We had that series so that people could could learn, essentially, mm-hmm. how to start a garden.
That's amazing. That's really great. That's really helpful. I know. I noticed that, in one of the videos, you also mentioned how to start small and don't take a big bite. And I know I've taught people how to grow food as well. And one of the things you do often is it's like your eyes are bigger than your stomach. You're like, mm-hmm. this, and I'm going to get that, and I'm going to grow this, and I'm going to grow that. And then all of a sudden, you have more work than you really were ready for.
Oh, yeah. That happens a lot, too. People get excited. You know, they see our videos. They see how much we grow, or, they see us different techniques we use. And we grow, in raised beds. We grow in containers. We grow on the ground so we can show people how versatile it is. But that doesn't mean you have to.
Right.
If you want to stick with containers, stick with containers. If you want to do raised bed, that's good, too. Or if you want to grow on the ground, that's fine as well. But this, we do that for versatility. And it's easy. You can start looking through a seed catalog and get really excited, and all of a sudden you have $30 worth of seeds that you may not have the space for. So it's definitely good to start small, especially if it's your first year. Start with what you can. Start with what you know. And I grew up in the city, and we had just a 4x4 spot, and all we did was took our seeds. We didn't buy seedlings or start seedlings. We just took our seeds, put them in the ground on Memorial Day weekend, let it do its thing, and then throughout the summer just tend to it. And that's how we gardened forever. And that was what worked. But I think if I didn't know Joey, I probably would be overwhelmed if I had tried to start seeds and, started with a big area and things like that. So I think people need to realize that you do need to start small and start with what you can manage and grow what you know you're going to eat. If you don't like okra, don't grow it just because your grandmother did. Just grow tomatoes then or whatever.
Right. Although, I'd never had okra before. And when I grew okra, and then I got to taste it, and it was fantastic. And I really enjoyed growing it. It was a lot of fun. So maybe obviously the staples, a couple of the staples, and maybe go adventure with one thing, to
right. Yeah. If you want to try something that maybe you've never grown before, go ahead and try it. We did that. We probably do that every year. Not every year necessarily, but if we're looking through some seed catalogs or wherever we are, we see something different, we might try it. Sometimes it's worth it if you have the space and the time and want to. You definitely can try something different because it may be a success for you.
Yeah. I remember growing kohlrabi. The first time I had a full-blown vegetable garden, I planted kohlrabi, and I'd never eaten it before, but, it was in the brassicas, and I love brassicas, and I thought, mm-hmm. it's a cool-looking plant, and it's delicious.
Yeah.
That's, to me, that was such a fun thing to do, to try something for the first time in my life that I had grown. It's such an adventure. It's really very exciting. Now, the next phase, after we grow all this beautiful food, the season starts to change and we have an excess, and that's when the canning comes in. And you're an exceptional canner. Can you tell us a little bit about, what people need to know about canning and, how much time it takes and what you can preserve?
Sure. So canning is a science. Just like baking, you want to make sure you combine the right things so that your cake rises or your bread rises or whatever. Canning is definitely a science. It's not something that you want to just fly by the seat of your pants because it could result in you getting very sick and people have died from it. So you want to keep that in mind. You have to be safe because you are putting food up for storage without using a freezer or refrigerator. So it's definitely something that, not to scare anybody, but it is something that you want because of a reputable recipe, something within that has been published past 19 about 1995, and you also want to make sure that you're clean. You know, if you're gonna they're gonna make pickles, make sure you clean your cucumbers so that they're clean, and you want to keep your area nice and clean as well, so that you don't have to worry about any extra bacteria or dirt or whatever getting into your preserves. And then also just start, if you're going to start canning, start with something small. The first thing I canned was cucumbers, pickles, and then salsa. I think it was salsa. Yeah. So those are the first, or maybe it was pasta, something like that. So those are the first two things I canned. And actually, I like I said, I grew up in the city. I had never canned in my life. I think I maybe one time helped my mom freeze some green beans, but I had never done any of that. And so I learned a lot from Joey because he grew up on a farm and he learned a lot from his grandma and his mother. So he taught me some different things, but then I wanted to learn more. So I took some classes from my local rec department. And the nice thing about that is that if you have the opportunity to take those classes, there's an expert there. They're going to teach you a lot of great information. And usually the price is not that bad considering you get to take a lot of the items home with you. So I went to the class and I learned more and I just kept going. I went to probably, just a handful of different classes. But it definitely helped me learn a lot and understand that canning is the safety part of it's important. If you're going to, there's a difference between canning high acid foods and low acid foods versus making a jam where you add sugar or making a pickle where you add the acid. We add the vinegar, so there's definitely a science behind it.
So if someone was going to start, what would be the easiest thing for them to start with, inexpensive and simpler? What would be the simplest thing to start with canning?
Probably like a salsa or a pasta sauce or some type of pickle, whether it be a cucumber pickle or pickled beets, any of those combinations.
Mm-hmm. My first canning was green cherry tomatoes.
There you go.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
They were delicious.
Canning tomatoes in general is pretty simple as well.
And it's the acidity in them also helps prevent them from being, going bad, correct?
Yes, and it's very important to... Now with tomatoes, they've learned because when you have fresh-grown tomatoes, any tomatoes really, the acidity can vary, so you do want to add a little bit of acid in the way of lemon juice or vinegar to your jars. But yeah, the acidity is pretty high generally in tomatoes.
And do you have recipes that you offer on your website?
Yeah, our website, we do have recipes and we have some videos. I do have an ongoing series called Canning What You Grow. And you may not see a lot throughout the winter, but starting probably as soon as June, I'll have more stuff on there again. But it's all, from the past years, it's all on there as well. And I showed how to do many different things, canning pumpkin to potatoes to jam, salsas, pasta sauce. We have a pear tree, so we show how to can a lot of pear stuff, which is, basically interchangeable with apples. So, yeah, there's a lot of different things you can do there.
I am so hungry right now. Just hearing that. It's like this time of year you can just see the promise of all your fruit trees out there and your berry bushes, and it's like, oh, you're going to be so full of yummy things by the end of the season. Oh, right now it's just like you just want to take care of your babies and make sure that they do very well. Have you had, I'm going to segue into a more of the, like just the social justice part of gardening. Have you had any issues with people saying, I tried to grow vegetables in my front yard and the town said no? Do you have any advice? Have you had anything like that come up?
We haven't had anybody tell us personally, but I know that, we've heard about people in Florida, and then if you've ever heard of Ron Finley, he started a whole urban food both in the Los Angeles area.
Right.
And then I know, like, there's not even just about growing food, but then there's water collection. There, if you want to harvest rainwater, I know different jurisdictions won't want you either. So there's those problems as well. But I can't think of a time personally that somebody said that, you know, had sent us an email about it or said anything about it. I know that a lot of, actually, you know, we do have a friend that lives in a subdivision, and the homeowners association kind of looks down upon growing in the front yard. And he had put in some, I guess you could call it edible landscaping, where you wouldn't know that it was vegetables unless you really knew what you were looking for.
Right.
And then there's another lady that she lives outside of Chicago, and she plants in her front yard, and she doesn't have any problems with it because she talks with her neighbors, but she had somebody graffiti her fence, and somebody came and painted over it for her, a nice little mural on it, and her homeowners association wanted her to take it down, and she ended up having people give donations to pay for the fine for it. Mm. So there's definitely things you have to battle. A lot of the times it may not be necessarily growing food. It may come from harvesting rainwater or even things like the city, and we live in Wisconsin and outside of Milwaukee, and the city of Milwaukee will allow you to have chickens, but it will not allow you to butcher the chickens.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there's that as well.
You could take your chicken somewhere to have it butchered for you.
Yeah, you can't butcher them yourself.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they're trying to avoid people having small businesses where they're just, I don't know, it just seems sort of, it's a small, if you're allowed to have a couple of chickens.
My thought is that I wouldn't tell anybody, and I would just do it in my basement.
Right, exactly. You know, I mean, exactly. I know.
But
I have my chicken story. I have on my side of the street, I'm not allowed to have chickens because of the zoning. But on the other side of the street, the block that I'm on, they can have chickens.
Oh.
Because of the zoning, it's I'm in quarter acre zoning, and on the other side it's half acre zoning, and of course the houses there are still in quarter acre plots, so it's not about the actual size of your property. It's just zoning. It has nothing to do with actual, you know, apples to apples. Nothing. It's just arbitrary. So it's very frustrating.
Yeah, that sounds frustrating.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, like, for instance, Guy right now, he's traveling through Europe, and he's noticed how there are community gardens everywhere. It's not.
Yeah.
It's just part of the landscape.
Yes, it is. And that's another thing, is that we talk to a lot of YouTubers who live in Europe, especially England, and they all have allotments there, and they wait forever to get an allotment, and it's like the thing to do. It's you know, it's the greatest thing, I don't know, since sliced bread or whatever, to have a garden. And here in the U.S., people are fighting it. You know, they're getting pissed at their neighbors because they're growing tomatoes in their backyard. But if you live in the U.K., apparently you have to wait to have your allotment passed down to you. And that just kind of blows my mind that, you know, in the United States, which is supposed to be the land of the free and whatever, we're getting mad at our neighbors for wanting to harvest rainwater, but in these other countries, they're fighting for the space.
Right, because they know. They have memory, and they have stories, so they remember living through the hunger times.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have that here. I mean, it'll come, but we don't, you know, we haven't had that really, except for maybe during the Great Depression. And interestingly enough, you know, I'm a history teacher. The Great Depression didn't affect the food issues, did not affect the whole country. There's certain parts of the country you know, where they had the Dust Bowl, that's where they got hit hard, and the poor were disproportionately affected. So most of the people really, you know, that was the Great Depression. There were, you know, no jobs. And people didn't really go hungry like they did, you know, during World War II. Are you still there? I hear clicking. I think we have lost Holly. Well, maybe while we try to get Holly back on the phone, I will ramble on about how permaculture has been one of the leading techniques in trying to reclaim the connection with earth and food. And hopefully, you know, we were hoping that, you know, permaculture would be the answer. 20-some years ago, we came, you know, it was developed, you know, permanent agriculture created this revolutionary way of thinking where it ties all of the different things that we need, you know, water, food, fiber, medicine, shelter, and you create a closed system. It's not ever really closed, but the idea is that there nothing goes to waste, and you're constantly reusing things and putting things back into the soil. You have animals in this system that contribute to the system. You're not just using animals and then killing them and having to have more animals brought in. There's a cycle that works beautifully. And, you know, it's an incredible system that's actually desalinated soils in the Middle East and brought soil that's been so devastated with salts and drought, brought them back to life by using permaculture methods. And recently I started studying edible forest gardening through David Jackie and Eric Tunzemeyer. They have an incredible two-volume book. These books are gigantic. And they have this, it's just a whole amazing setup on how to create an edible forest garden that is self-sustaining. Is Holly back? Do we have you back?
Yeah, I'm back. Sorry about that. I don't know what happened. I apologize.
That's all right. I rambled on about permaculture until we got you back. So we were talking about, you know, people not being allowed to harvest water. And
yeah.
And this is an interesting thing because it seems that water is a human right, like food. And, you know, what's going on in California right now is just absolutely horrifying.
Yeah.
And have a drought that's, you know, that's our breadbasket.
Mm-hmm. It is horrifying. What is even more horrifying to me is that they've been warned for the past 8 years. And yet a lot of these people don't even pay attention. And I have a friend out there who was helping his neighbor lay some sod, and I'm thinking, okay, now you have to continually water that. And, you know, they're in the Los Angeles area where most of this drought is having the problem or continuing, you know, it's not getting any better. And I'm thinking, why would you continue to do that? It's like they just have a total disregard for what's going on. And it's kind of, you know, if that happened in Wisconsin, I would hope that people would pay attention and not let it just go on. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It just seems like now it's going to be too little too late. And it's quite frightening. As somebody who is, especially myself, who's studying environmental science, it's like, it's like the writing's on the wall. What's going to happen is, are people going to have to relocate? You know, they have looked into water purification processes like reverse osmosis, which is quite costly, but is that what, you know, what they're going to have to do or what? And they're finally, considering they only have a year worth of water left, I guess, they're finally, you know, restricting restaurants and businesses to using less water and not offering water to patrons and things like that. And it's like, why didn't this start 8 years ago, you know?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, hindsight is 2020.
Yeah, right?
But it does make you wonder, you know, why is it that we have to wait until catastrophe strikes for us to start thinking about it? They're not even doing anything yet, really. They're just thinking about it still. You know,
right.
Realistically, they're not, you know, I mean, I know some people have friends out there. I have some friends, and they don't seem too worried. They're just talking about, you know, oh, the government will bring us water. They'll take care of us. they're just not, you know, it just seems there's such a strange disconnect. You know, it's baffling. How do you think it'll affect the rest of the country? Do you think people should start growing gardens to prepare for a shortage?
Well, we had actually talked about that on the podcast about how the, you know, one of the big crops that we get from California is strawberries, and then almonds too. I guess it takes like a gallon of water to produce one almond or something. It's just insane how much water it takes.
Right.
So then you think about that, and it's like, okay, well, you might not be able to grow almonds, but most people can grow strawberries. And then I know there's a few crops that, well, I guess we'll have to see what happens, but you could definitely grow strawberries, you know, in your yard, and they're a perennial, so they do come back year after year. And, but yeah, I think I would see this as a sign. If I wasn't growing food, and if I wasn't supporting my local food movement, I would start looking into it. Just in general, just to maybe even just start like a 4x4 garden to have that knowledge and that usage. Because you don't know. You don't know what's going to happen with California. You don't know if that drought could spread. Just even looking at the population of the earth, with how many people are on the earth, at some point there's going to be a breaking point. And I was talking with my chiropractor about this, and he said that with the global warming, it's almost like the earth has a fever. And what's going to happen is the earth is sick. There's going to be epidemics. There's going to be droughts. There's going to be famine. And maybe that's how the earth is going to heal itself. And I know that the earth is going to be okay, but what's going to happen to the people on the earth? If we continue to be stupid and not look into alternative energy methods, or perhaps, you know, cutting down, the average American meal travels 1,500 miles from farm to plate. You know, there's a lot you can do to prevent that from happening, to burn fossil fuels and also to have fresh food. Your food is going to be fresh as opposed to, you know, losing its nutrients in that distance. So there's a lot that could change, but people just seem, you know, oblivious to it, or they think the government's going to take care of them, or they just don't care. And that's quite frustrating to me on many levels. But I think the best thing you could do is invest in some time into your backyard or containers or whatever and just grow something. Even if you live in a studio apartment, you can still sprout seeds, you know, by your kitchen sink.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you can support your local farmers markets or join a CSA or anything of that sort.
Right. Support your local farmers. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm always amazed. You know, people, I do landscape designing and gardening for people, and I'm always like, how would you like to put in a fruit tree? You know, instead they want to put in, you know, some flowering trees that doesn't produce any food at all. You know, you could throw in a berry bush over here. You know, oh, no, I want to put an azalea thing. Okay, well, now we have to spray it because the deer are going to eat it. you know, there's a big disconnect. I don't understand. I don't know what, short of a disaster, will make people, you know, become more aware.
And as we were kind of you were talking about the depression, and if you think about Victory Gardens, you know, people were being encouraged to grow food into can, and now it seems like that's not necessarily the case. And I don't know why. You know, I don't understand why they don't want us to grow food or preserve food, but I suppose they want control. But that is something that people think, okay, well, my grandparents did that. I'm not going to do that. And I would rather do things that my grandparents did than not do what they did, personally. My grandparents were very smart people, and they, you know, their parents lived on a lot less than what most people have today. So I would rather use something or grow something or whatever as much as I can.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. My father remembers growing up, you know, as a child, they didn't have electricity, but they had a wood stove. And my grandfather built their home, and they had a garden. And in the garden were all kinds of fruit trees. And, you know, my dad is 82 next month. Holy cow. And he still remembers that as being one of the most wonderful times of his life, is going out into the garden and picking the fruit and eating it off the trees. And that's one of my favorite memories as a child as well. I lived in Greece as a kid, and I had a lemon tree out my window on one side and an apricot tree on the other and a fig tree in the back. And I'm telling you, it was like, you know, it was the Garden of Eden. It was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you try to recreate that here, and people think you're crazy. You know, why don't you just plant a nice, pretty flowering tree or a weeping willow or some, you know, fake cherry tree that doesn't, you know. I'm like, no, I want to have something to eat that's delicious and pretty. Oh, and do you guys use, I know you're organic. Do you use any other kinds of do you use permaculture methods or
We do have we kind of in our situation we can't do too much permaculture, but we do have strawberries, and we do have sunchokes, which are Jerusalem artichokes, which are perennial, and then we have a pear tree, and in our kitchen we have a dwarf lime tree. So those are kind of more permaculture based as opposed to anything else. But yeah, that's what we do have right now.
Oh, that's great. So you're more of a suburban type of situation.
Yes.
And I think that's what a lot of people have to work with, you know, with the suburban type of situation. And I think that, you know, if you know, people listening out there, if you haven't grown a garden yet, I mean, thinking about it, definitely check out their website. You know, can you give them that website address?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Our website is thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com.
Well,
and we have lots of information. Even if you're not in Wisconsin, we have lots of information for you. If you have a question, we have a contact us button, and you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that. And we like to, you know, help out. If you, like I said, if you have a question, we're more than happy to get you information. It usually takes us less than 24 hours to get back to you.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's really great. Mm-hmm. And the two of you seem really sweet together, and you work together, and that's a really interesting thing, because a lot of couples, you know, working together might not be the easiest thing in the world for them. How do you do that? How do you make that work?
I think we're just both passionate about the same things in regards to, you know, growing food and being self-sufficient and the environment. So I think that's what works for us. I don't think we could work 40 hours a week together and then work on this project together. So since it's our hobby, I always tell people it's kind of like our baby, and it is. It's something that we work on together, and we've developed from the very beginning stages. And I have an off switch. Joey doesn't. I can stop thinking about it, but he'll, you know, get up in the middle of the night and mumble something to me about website or something. And I'm like, just go back to sleep. But, but yeah. So I think there's a balance. Like I said, he's more of the organizer, and I'm the one that can kind of, you know, I can communicate with people really well, and I can send the emails, and I can make the phone calls, and I can do a lot of things on the website, and he kind of thinks of, like, you know, this week we're going to, you know, it's time for us to plant cabbage, but we're also going to talk about using toilet paper rolls in the garden or something like that. So, so yeah, so we have that good balance between, I'm a very creative person, but at the same time, I think he's kind of more creative when it comes to the whole gardening thing as well. So I guess it's just kind of finding our balance with each other and making sure that we, you know, we take our time away from the website and the garden in, as we need to.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good advice for anybody to make sure that you do spend that special time together. That's really great. So have you had any people with, you know, pets and issues like that with the gardens?
Like couples having problems? Or
yeah, right. Yeah, your pets are picking them up, and I've got woodchucks, and then I've got squirrels.
Oh, pets. Okay. Yeah, I mean, we have people that ask us all the time about deer, squirrels, rabbits, sometimes birds. I haven't heard much about woodchucks, but that may be a regional thing. I'm not really sure. Chipmunks. The biggest thing you can do for your garden is if you're worried about any sort of pests, whether it be rabbits, squirrels, mostly rabbits. Rabbits are a big problem, especially in the urban or suburban areas. So you put a little fence around your garden about 2 feet high. You just use a chicken wire, and you spread on the entire perimeter of your garden as soon as you can. We leave ours up. We left ours up during the winter, but you want to do that, you know, as soon as you can so that the rabbits stay away.
Mm.
That's a good one. And then chipmunks, people will say different things, like take a bucket of water with a little ramp up to it and then put, you know, seeds or whatever on the ramp, and then they fall into the bucket. Probably not the most humane thing, but if you're having problems with them, then that's what you have to do. If you're dealing with deer, a lot of people do a double fence where they put one fence on the garden and put another fence, and then it kind of spooks the deer because they feel kind of trapped.
Mm-hmm.
So then they're generally not going to come back and bother your garden. We've heard anything from putting tin pie plates out to spook the deer, bars of soap, slugs, you know, slugs you would bury a container at ground level and put deer in it, and then the slugs fall into the deer. So there's many different solutions, even using something like, I've heard people using like human hair for rabbits. So there's many different solutions that you can try and do, but a lot of times it just takes a fence, and that will help you. If you have, moles, a lot of times people will put down hardware netting to prevent them from getting up into the raised beds. So there's many solutions you can do where you don't have to be, you know, adding chemicals to your landscape.
And coyote urine, I hear, is also a good way to ward off. Coyote urine.
Oh, yeah, there you go. That's another one.
you soak it in strips of cloth and you put it around, and that makes the woodchucks and other little critters avoid your garden. But I think it's expensive.
I think it is. I'm not really sure. We haven't had to deal with that, but I'm sure it's not cheap.
Yeah.
But if it works, and maybe you don't want to put a fence up or something, or how we have to prevent the woodchucks, then that might be worth the investment.
Mm-hmm. And one of the big the other big questions is how do you control weeds, you know, without using Roundup?
Sure. So there's you have to pull the weeds generally. If you're trying to control, weeds
that's
in an area that's not say you're like you have weeds in the in between the lines of your sidewalk. A lot of times, I know you can use like hot water and vinegar, and that will help it. I wouldn't put that in your garden bed necessarily because I don't know how long it will affect the growth. But I've heard people using that, in non-edible areas. I know there's a non-toxic product called Avenger, and it's a citrus-based weed killer.
Oh,
so you could look into that. And then sometimes we don't. We have friends that don't pull all their weeds, and they kind of let the plants grow, and it's kind of a survival of the fittest situation where they may pull some weeds, enough, but then they let them grow, and then the plants that come out the strongest, they save those seeds, and that means those plants are the winners.
Right.
So there's that option, too. If you have a neighbor that, doesn't like the way it looks or something, then you would have to pull your weeds. And another thing is that a lot of bad bugs are attracted to weeds, so that's maybe another reason not to weed. But yeah, it's definitely, you have to kind of control them as much as you can, whether that be take a half an hour every evening after work and pull some weeds, then that may be what you have to do, or, pull... Make sure you get them before they get an inch tall or seed to prevent weeds from coming back. We use what's called a raised berm method, where we have designated areas for planting and designated areas for walking, and this prevents compaction in our soil. So what we did last fall is we pulled as many weeds as we could in many of the raised berms, and we pulled down to the roots as far as possible to prevent them from coming back this year. Now, we didn't get to all of our raised berms, but if you continue to do this, then it's going to prevent less and less from coming. And then now we have the areas mulched with leaves, and that allows for smothering a lot of the weeds and also moisture control. So a lot of times you can use things like mulch and then, pull the weeds, mulch them out so that it helps prevent the weeds from coming up.
Great. Well, Holly, we are out of time. I just want to thank you so much for coming on today. Holly Baird, she and Joey Baird are the founders of the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener. It's been great talking with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. Take care.
All right. Thank you.
I'm Pauline Schneider. This is Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. That's our show. Please make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, on the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. Feel free to post questions or anything you'd like us to address on the show. Check out Guy's blog, GuyMcPherson.com, for more updates, essays, and speaking tours. I will be back again next week. I will be covering for both Mike and Guy, who will still be away. And thanks again to everybody and to AfroZen. And until next time, remember that dominant culture has been very clever. But in the end, nature bats last.